Hello, and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm Graham Davis, the digital editor of Investors Chronicle. Our editor, John Heumann, is missing in action this week, and his usual wingman, Phil Oakley, is also missing. So this week I'm joined by a couple of young guns, Tom Dines. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
And Alex Jeniad.
Hello, Alex.
It's been another mixed week on the markets. Geopolitical concerns continue to ride roughshod over investor sentiment. But first of all, we'll come to geopolitical stuff and the global perspective a little bit later. First of all, I wanted to look at UK-focused news from this week's magazine. First of all, starting off with you, Alex, this story that just won't go away, Woodford.
So, yes, Neil Woodford. So in case you've been living under a rock, former star manager Neil Woodford's equity income fund suspended, and Andrew Bailey, chief executive of the Financial Conduct Authority, appeared in front of the Treasury Select Committee this week in front of a pugilistic Nicky Morgan. And there are a number of takeaways from this. Emma Powell and I, our main sort of angle on this story was concerns that Mr. Bailey raised over fee discounts negotiated by Hargreaves Lansdown for the funds that are listed on their Wealth 50 kind of best buys list. There's a lot of scrutiny on funds that are on all of these platforms, not just HL, so-called best buys. So if you're a Hargreaves Lansdown customer and you buy from these funds, HL will negotiate a discount on the annual management charge of usually around 30% on average. And Andrew Bailey has questioned whether these fee discounts ended up fueling excessive inflows into the fund, which then in turn may have compromised Neil Woodford's investment strategy.
A victim of his own success, potentially, but also a victim of this.
It's an interesting hypothesis, and it's not one I've come across before, but yeah, essentially the fund will have had a certain timeline, certain objectives associated with that timeline and scale. The fund grew, in the words of Mr. Bailey, too big too quickly, something he suggested, and that it's difficult to know what exactly Andrew Bailey means by this. He did, when asked, is this a failure of rules or regulation, he very much pointed, perhaps as he would, to the rules. I'm fairly sceptical with the idea. I don't know. The story's moved on from Neil Woodford is a bad stock picker to the fund had excessive illiquidity, and now we're being told it was too big for its own good. It seems like a lot of diagnoses for different problems, really. So yeah, one to look out for. I mean, in these select committee hearings are quite revealing. They're quite interesting. There's a lot of narrative around them. Andrew Bailey is the hot favourite at the moment for the governorship of the Bank of England. He, of course, spent many years there. That is now under question. And we'd expect to see other figures in this saga appear in front of that committee eventually. Certainly Neil Woodford, Hargreaves Lansdown will be there. Link Fund Solutions is the administrator of the fund. We'll also expect to be there. And this is really, the last couple of days has really accelerated this story, but a perceived conflict of interest that arose a few years ago. So essentially, Woodford Investment Management employed a financial advisory company called Duff & Phelps to value the illiquid holdings in their own fund, which the FCA decided years ago was unacceptable. So
these are the unquoted investments, which are notoriously difficult to value.
Yes. So it's not quite the sense that Woodford are deciding how much their own holdings are worth, but they were paying someone to do that. So that relationship was then passed over to Link. What is interesting is the FT last night broke an exclusive that the FCA had recommended Link to Woodford. So despite having censured Link on a number of occasions prior to that, there's also questions around that. I think so far the FCA haven't really commented, but
it seems a bit cozy.
Yeah, background. Exactly. There's a lot of overlap, and it's difficult to tell at this point. It's difficult to know where the fee discount question will go. I don't know how you would regulate that. There doesn't seem to be anything going morally untoward, and it's certainly not something I've come across in the context of any other fund management. My personal view is I don't think this is something that's going to be run. That's going to run further, but it's an interesting one for our readers, interesting who may well be Hargreaves Lansdown customers, who may suddenly think, and already may be quite concerned over the performance of the best buy funds and the funds they've been buying into, in part due to the not formal advice from Hargreaves Lansdown, but certainly the encouragement via the content on the website. They may now think again and question whether these funds are actually well, whether the strategies of these funds and the sizes are aligned.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of words expounded over this, I guess, in recent weeks, and this podcast itself, John and Phil talked about this at length recently. But you know, there are concerns clearly if the parliamentary committees are raising it over these best buy lists and how they encourage people.
Yeah, it should be said that Hargreaves Lansdown don't take a fee just for having those funds on the list. I just want to clarify that.
But this committee this week was more of a fact finding. There's no finger pointing going on. This is a fact finding.
So there are letters being sent from the committee, the FCA back and forth, Guernsey Stock Exchange as well. We're hearing from all the figureheads. And at the moment, we're still, I think, in early days of this story.
But yeah, there's a long way to run. I mean, we still haven't got to the first 28 days of it being gated. Have we?
And so therefore, at that point, it will come under review again.
Yeah.
Mr. Woodford still continues to draw his fee, and that's something that the committee and Andrew Bailey were aligned on in their position, where really he should probably be waiving that now. Although Bailey did observe that arguably he's doing more management of the fund than he's ever had to do before.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I see that he has made some progress in selling holdings in that fund. He's raised some of the money that's been requested for redemptions. And I think this week also there was a takeover offer for BCA Marketplace, in which...
That's right, in which Woodford has a holding.
So again, that's going to help boost his coffers, as it were, which is what he needs to do at the moment.
I'm not sure the timeline on that. Don't know how quickly he needs the liquidity. Long term, that probably.
Now, BCA Marketplace is automobiles, yeah?
Yes.
Car sales. Tom, you had an FCA related story as well. Good segue there to your story on the FCA and car sales.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So there's been a few concerns over the auto retail sector in general. On one hand, because car registrations, both new and used cars, are declining year on year. I think off the top of my head, the last time used car sales were up was something like first quarter of 2017. So it's been kind of a long running trend. Separately, financing concerns about auto finance, these arrangements where you can get a new car and you pay off X amount every month. Basically, the FCA did a probe into it, which concluded earlier this year, saying that these arrangements may be harming consumers and costing as much as £300 million more annually than a flat fee commission model. So that's a fair concern. Now, the investigation to Lookers is seemingly related to that. They did an independent review which uncovered control issues with the group sale processes. That's not to say that they've necessarily done anything unethical. Nothing has been found. And Peel Hunt, in fact, noted that they sell manufacturer finance deals. They have no say. Lookers themselves do not have any say over interest rates or commissions or anything like that. Problem appears to be more administrative than some sort of more fundamental problem with the products or the pricing.
Finance is provided by a third party.
Essentially.
By the Lookers.
And they sell it on
showroom.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, basically it's a big unknown. And given how nervous the market is about auto retailers, any unknown is taken as a pretty bad thing. So when this came out about 3 o'clock on, I think it was Tuesday, the shares immediately down 24%. They recovered quite strongly. But it just goes to show sort of how nervous people are about this sector. Just 2 weeks ago, we had Pendragon warning they were going to be significantly loss-making in the first half of the year. And so it's just a bit... People are very, very nervous about what's going on. So there's a lot of... No one really knows what's going to happen with Lookers at the moment. But we took them off a buy because it's just not a great place to be, and any added uncertainty is very unwelcome.
Are there any chinks of light in that sector?
Valuations are pretty low. potentially, it's not so clear how to access them. This might actually be something that Alex would be better able to speak to. So alternative fuel vehicles is the only sector that's consistently growing in terms of new registrations, although that is a very low base. And it's, not all that clear how to access it or how high it's likely to go. But things like hybrid vehicles, electric vehicles, that sort of thing, seems to be picking up a lot of steam.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Alex. Moving on with news this week, looking more globally, geopolitical concerns continue to sort of dominate the markets. And Donald Trump has sort of held off on firing cruise missiles this week, thankfully. But he still is firing off crude threats via Twitter. Japan and India were in his sights this week before he flew out to the G20 summit, which is happening in Japan over the weekend. And I think global trade and protectionism are going to dominate those talks, certainly. Trump, I think, is going to be meeting President Xi China for the first time since their latest round of tariffs. This leads us on to one company that you wanted to talk about, Alex, IQE, which has been hammered by this trade war.
Yeah, so IQE, they make semiconductors, basically bits for phones. They've been a bit of an interesting growth story the last few years, but, well, they guided in May that they'd expect some short-term disruption owing to the Trump trade disputes. And Huawei, who they've got quite a bit of exposure to through their own customers, have been listed by the United States Department of Commerce, along with 68 of Huawei's affiliates, on a list that bans the sale of products covered by basically its export regulations without having a specific and appropriate export license, basically making it very hard for exports. So IQE had said that, you know, things will be fine in the long run. They've now then revised that down, so they expect their revenues to could well come in below last year and below a prior consensus of 175 million, a range around 140 to 165. So shares went down by nearly 40% off the back of that. I guess one of the things with IQE is it's not just that it's a healthy company experiencing a bad time. All of the sector has taken a bit of a hit. Broadcom, a giant in the sector, also has signaled concern over this. It's more that it's a company that's in a bad way internally. They had disruption in their photonics division supply chain, so semiconductor laser diodes, and so that basically contributed to a fall in demand. They've built up a lot of stock, and we've seen in this section in the past that basically the rate of technological advance is so great that what you do not want is lots of stock building up and sitting around. So they're having to unwind inventories in a soft market. Their CapEx has gone up in recent years, so the returns on capital are pretty poor. The free cash conversion is pretty poor.
So this was a company that, although the recent trade issues have obviously compounded its problems, there were problems already there.
Yeah, I took them down to a sell off the results in March off the back of their internal disruption, never pleased, but being vindicated in that decision. But yeah, nobody's safe, certainly in semiconductors. I think it's interesting the point you make on India, and that I've written the words China, US-China trade war to death in my articles, but a lot of industrial businesses have moved production out of China into neighbouring countries, one of which is India.
Yep.
So now if Trump goes to war with India, because I think the US removes some kind of favourable trade arrangement between the US and India, and India imposed some retaliatory tariffs, which may have been a bit myopic, because if now Trump is going to turn on them as well, I don't know to what extent that would be considered before, and I dread to think what's going to happen. These companies were facilities in places like Vietnam, but
keep
moving around.
Where does it end?
It's how integrated your supply chain is as well. So if it's deeply integrated, then you've got a problem. If you move things flexibly around, it'll cost you, but not too bad. It's very interesting to see what will happen, I think, regards to India for across the industrial sector.
Indeed. And also, I saw a great graphic in the FT this week showing the shift in trade between the US and Vietnam in recent months.
There's a giant export surplus, isn't there?
Yep.
And these are definitely Vietnamese goods. They're not Chinese goods. They're definitely Vietnamese.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Very interesting how quickly this globalized economy can morph and change and shift to different jurisdictions. It's really interesting to see how this is going to pan out. Whether we'll get more out of that this weekend at the G20, I'm not sure. I think it could be volatile. Okay, so IQE is one to definitely strike off for now. The question is, I guess, for a lot of these companies is really, if the tariff situation gets resolved, how quickly is this business?
I mean, this is unprecedented. So it's very difficult to project forward. We've seen slowdowns in the past, but also given the rise of China, it's the first time we've seen anything like this in the context of a nation like China developing at its rate. So it's very difficult to know. I think it's more, you know, if you did hold it, it's more going to stay away, really. Yep.
The Huawei situation is particularly interesting, I think, because even tariffs or no tariffs, it looks as though Trump's got Huawei in his sights.
Yeah, and there are national security questions as well. There's certainly a difference of opinion between the US and the UK. The UK seem willing to let Huawei do certainly some non-core infrastructure work for now. Trump seems dead against it. With the likely arrival of Boris Johnson, I wonder whether that work will be allowed to carry on and what that will mean for companies further down the supply chain, obviously.
Yes, one to watch there, I think. Now, also on sort of the geopolitical angle, relations between the US and Iran have deteriorated further in the past week or so. And sticking with that region, that obviously Saudi and Iran are major players in the Gulf region. And there's some fairly substantial news this week regarding arms sales to Saudi that you wrote, Alex, as well. What's the story there?
So temporarily, the UK government is not going to grant new licenses for the sale of arms to Saudi Arabia, and the eight other countries in its coalition that might be used in the Yemen conflict. So step back. So Saudi Arabia led a group of nine countries into conflict in Yemen since 2015. As of November 2018, it's very difficult to get official figures for this, 6,872 civilians have been killed, 10,768 wounded, mostly by Saudi Arabia-led airstrikes, and that's according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. The likely number of casualties is much higher. Where we come into this as a country is that we have a big arms industry, and our main player really is a company called BAE Systems, which I'm sure you'll be familiar with.
Yep.
BAE Systems generated around 14% of the revenues from Saudi Arabia last year. They have a history going back to 1966 with Saudi. It should be said that arms contracts are done via the UK government. So the UK government and Saudi have an arrangement, and then BAE will provide, and others, and we'll come to those others, provide aircraft, support systems and weaponry, along with, importantly here, training and support services. In 2017, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade organization appealed a High Court judgment which had allowed the sale of arms for use in this conflict. And the Court of Appeal this month have decided, actually, sale of arms to Saudi Arabia are unlawful, and that's because governments are expected to carry out due diligence to ensure that licenses aren't granted for equipment that might be used for the commission of serious violations of humanitarian law.
And it's pretty clear in this case that this equipment is being used in Yemen.
So the government denies that it is contesting this position, and it says it's done its due diligence. BAE provides, it leads a consortium to provide Eurofighter Typhoon aircraft to Saudi Arabia. It leads a consortium across Europe. Germany have disrupted that by banning sale of arms to Saudi Arabia following the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, something that BAE Systems have since said may well financially impact the company. There's some very good reporting in The Guardian earlier this month on actually the true role of BAE. And it must be said that BAE say that their involvement in supporting the Saudi Air Force is limited to providing equipment, support and training. Former workers and MOD and MOD Mandarin have suggested to the Guardian and dispatches that BAE's role goes further than this. And in the words of one former BAE employee, the jets literally couldn't function. They wouldn't get into the sky without the support of BAE. So it's this question of how active is the UK and how active is BAE Systems in this conflict. Now, BAE may be the main player here. Obviously, yeah, as I said before, we have a big aerospace and defence contingent. Rolls-Royce put the engines into the Eurofighter Typhoon. Meggitt provide braking systems, including wheels, carbon brakes, landing gear computers. Chemring have historically provided arms to Saudi Arabia. Cobham, meanwhile, the contract doesn't run anymore, but in 2014 they awarded a 30-month contract by BAE to provide air support to operational readiness training for the Saudi Air Force as part of the Saudi-British Defence Cooperation Programme. So there is a lot of involvement from a lot of companies. It should be said that BAE and Rolls-Royce, I've spoken to across the sector, were the only ones who actually commented and said, we are examining this judgment and recognise that we have exposure to this area. Every other company declined to comment. It's interesting the evolution of the way that these companies have discussed Saudi Arabia. I've been through a lot of company reports dating back for the last 10 years, and Chemring, an example of a company that openly discussed Saudi Arabia as a target market for munitions sales. Now you won't even really find references. In the most recent report, I would say Middle East. So Middle East replaces Saudi. But it's, I don't know, I think for an investor, I think you do take on that risk. You are buying into aerospace and defence. And while there are certainly, nations need weapons to preserve peace, we are also guilty, it looks like, of human rights violation. And to what extent do you want to be exposed to this? as an investor, the Labour government have said that they would ban arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
If they become the government.
If they became the government, mm-hmm. Labour Party, sorry. The Labour Party spokesperson has also told me that training would be off the menu as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's a lot of overlap here, so it's quite uncomfortable. I took Bayi off a buy to sell, not just because of this, because ultimately, while it's important, it can't be the only guiding factor. More risk is certainly an important risk when it comes to investment. Ultimately, in the BAE's recent results, sales and adjusted profits were down the previous year, free cash flow more than halved. And to put it briefly, it's not a great company right now, BAE.
I guess, there's, as you say, there's a 50-year history here of trade between BAE and involvement in Saudi Arabia. So investors have no excuse. They know what they're buying into. They're buying into an exposure to Saudi.
And so I think one of the strengths, one of the ball points of BAE has been what is guaranteed orders effectively forever, thanks to the UK government. But however long that lasts in the medium term, that may be up for debate now.
I mean, these are huge figures here. You're saying since this conflict started in 2015, UK has licensed sale of 4.7 billion of arms to Saudi in four years.
4 years. So, it's an industry that employs a lot of people in this country.
Mm.
It's an argument that politicians have made that we can't just do away with our arms industry, often on that basis, which particularly for a conservative government is quite a curiously Keynesian approach to employing economics.
So what's the situation now? Is that there is a stay on any sales
on new licenses? So existing licenses are fine.
So they will continue.
So BAE, for example, if they're shipping Eurofighter Typhoon, there's the old batch they can still sell, but there's a new batch they've agreed a memorandum of intent to sell, which would require a new license.
Mm.
So the question here is, what does this mean for future business between BAE and Saudi Arabia, along with everyone else? Officially, exposures amongst the vast majority of the sector is pretty limited to Saudi Arabia now, Chemring included, who have provided arms of force. It's really BAE, the big question marks over them.
And it is upon the UK government to challenge this, or the...
Yeah, the UK government will now have to challenge the Court of Appeal and make the case they did carry out due diligence, which will be interesting. There's just not much information on the ground in the public domain because it's impossible to send journalists to Yemen.
Mm.
And the Saudi government, obviously, has a rich history in the UK and the Saudi government, and who are not famed for being transparent, certainly on this sort of thing. So,
yeah. Okay.
Anything.
So you've taken BAE down to a hold on this uncertainty, and it sounds like you're not going to change that in the near term, at least.
No.
And watch out for the rest of the sector. Thank you very much, Alex. Now, moving on to one of the features for this week, and Tom's here to talk about this, streaming.
Yes. Tom,
I spend a lot of time at home staring at the back of my 10-year-old son's head as he plays Fortnite, so I know a little bit about streaming video games. But for our listeners, tell us a bit more about this industry. How big is it?
So it's essentially much bigger than anybody realise, because of the very reason you mentioned. So online gaming has been around since my dad stared at the back of my head from playing Age of Empires online. But essentially, Fortnite came out in 2017. Massive hit. Made something like $2.4 billion in revenues in 2018.
Wow.
And that's predominantly a younger audience who they compete against each other. They build maps and meet their friends, and it's become sort of a social thing as much as a competitive thing.
Yeah, it's almost a teen, early teen, pre-teen thing. When my son's 10, him and his friends are playing it, sort of. So it's a new demographic almost for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're not just playing it themselves. There's a massive, surprisingly large market in watching professional players play it on YouTube and things like that.
Tell me about
it. So for all the popularity of Fortnite, it's not strictly speaking streaming, because to play it, you still need to download it, install it, whatever. You basically need to buy something and download it to play the game.
Yep.
Streaming offers is much more like the analogy which others have used and that I've beaten to death in the piece is the Netflix of games. So at the start of this year, Reed Hastings, the chief executive of Netflix, said that they compete with and lose to Fortnite more than they do HBO, which is the sort of other big prestige TV show company in the US. So just kind of recalibrated the view of a lot of people that the entertainment industry is more about time on screen than it is what's going on that screen necessarily. So Google, Microsoft, and more or less any big tech company you could name is looking at the online streaming market, where you could essentially, with very limited equipment, so you don't have to spend a huge amount of money for a console the way you would with an Xbox One or a PlayStation 4, or even those like very specialized gaming PCs. You have maybe a controller or just something to actually get an internet connection for your TV. You pay a subscription and you have access to a library of games. You can buy additional games. You don't have to download anything. It's all available straight away. And it's available across a number of screens. So the mobile games market is huge for small games like Angry Birds or Solitaire or stuff that you play at a bus stop, essentially. What this offers is both anybody with a TV or any sort of screen can play high quality sort of prestige games anywhere they want, which massively increases the market.
So am I going to lose access to my television as well now?
Well, if you've got any smaller screens around the house, you could distract your son with those. So that's the investment appeal there is obvious. It's a huge market waiting to be tapped into. The secondary appeal is the UK has a pretty healthy subsector of video games development companies, whether that is people like Codemasters, who make racing games. They actually have one of their titles in the launch version of Google's streaming service, which is called Stadia. So when you sign up at launch, you can play Grid, which is the racing game, immediately. Other ones like Team 17, Frontier Developments, all these people who put the games together.
How is Codemasters monetizing that?
So they get 70% share of revenues from Stadia. Google keeps 30%, which was a concern because obviously if you liken it to, say, a Spotify, which was music streaming, a lot of musicians are pretty annoyed with how they were compensated. But the games industry so far has been very transparent and are giving the vast majority of the revenues to the developers themselves. So there's a few developers who make their own games for platforms. Then there's secondary sort of outsourced developers, people like Sumo Group or Keyword Studios, and they're essentially like outsourced development services. So we've got these massive games that you hear about, like a Red Dead Redemption sort of thing, which a massive game came out late last year, where it's an enormous, essentially the Old West, and you can go anywhere and do anything more or less. So given the sheer amount of development that goes into that, it's very common to hire outsourced studios to maybe design the animals or parts of the landscape, stuff like that. So the increasing prevalence of these larger prestige games on a whole range of screens increases the need for the services of people like Sumo Group and Keywords, and the need for content, which is after all how these massive streaming services will compete with one another, is good for the developers.
So these development companies, like the ones you mentioned, Sumo and like, they don't have to worry about the success of a game because they're going to get a contract to fulfill part of the game.
Yeah, so Sumo and Keywords would pay for the development process, much more like a sort of freelance thing,
like
I suppose.
Outsourced.
Whereas the people like Codemasters, for instance, they get a share of revenue for the game. So that would be presumably a bit more dependent on the success of the actual game.
Yeah. And what are valuations like for these companies? Are they true tech valuations?
No, these are... These are tech companies that make money. Yeah. they've got a definite set of skills. A lot of them have very, very long track records. Codemasters has been around for a long time. Team 17, the Worms franchise, has been around since the 90s on more or less every console that has existed since then.
Worms.
Great game.
Yeah. Everyone's played it, and there's like 40 versions of it. These companies have a track record. They are doing well enough now. This is essentially a huge opportunity for them if they can make the right relationships.
So what happens to the console makers? I mean, Microsoft is a console maker.
Yeah, so
is the console dead?
If it is, it's dying slowly. Basically, Sony, which make the PlayStation, and Microsoft, which make the Xbox, have both announced new console projects. And I've basically done what the tech industry does and have sold you a dream about how this thing's going to be amazing. At the end of the day, there is also a major concern about internet connectivity. In order to do these things competitively, you need a fast internet connection, which makes rolling it out quite difficult, especially once you get outside of major cities. So consoles are still in the picture for the moment because they just don't have that concern. Like I say, there's two major console companies, the two biggest ones really, planning to come out with a console. Both of those consoles will have, it's rumored, streaming capabilities. So it looks like in the medium term, you move from a console-based or download-based service to a sort of augmented service where you've got a console and the stuff, you can play all that stuff. You can also stream while they work out the kinks. And then in the long term, presumably move to a much cheaper, much more flexible full streaming model. But that technology isn't going to arrive overnight.
Yeah, it's a fascinating industry. And as I know, to my own cost, literally, it can, you know, they do know how to make money out of young people.
Yes.
Excellent. Fascinating stuff. Thanks, Tom. And that, there's more in the, on that feature in this week's magazine. There's plenty more in this week's magazine, including our main feature, which is on the UK property market. Phil Oakley is taking a look at the IPO of Trainline, another place where a lot of my money tends to go to. And we also have a sector focus talking about the conversation we had earlier on platforms. Our sector focus this week is looking at the different investment platforms. And our personal finance team has put together a feature on which platforms to choose to avoid hefty charges. So plenty in the magazine, available in all good news agents on Friday and on the web at www.investorschronicle.co.uk. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Tom. And thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.